This is the Voice of America, Studio One. Alaska, the Last Frontier, a program commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Alaska Purchase by the United States. Today, a portrait in sound of the promise of Alaska, the fourth and last in a series of programs on the history, the people, the legend, and the promise of the 49th state. Your reporter, Rhett Turner.
We've come to call Alaska, the 49th state of these United States, the last land frontier. It was the last great expanse of territory acquired by the United States in the 19th century as the nation expanded. Alaska was purchased from Russia in 1867 for $7,200,000. Today, Alaska is the last major area of the United States to be developed. In many ways, this state may be compared to young new nations in other parts of the world, which have undergone a change from colonial territories to nationhood. Alaska moved from a colonial territorial position to full statehood in 1959. Robert Atwood, editor of the Anchorage Times, is an articulate spokesman for developing Alaska. Here's how he described the change.
It's a revolution without any blood. It's a revolution in which we severed our ties with one government and created a new one. And yet we had a friendly government that we were severing our ties with, so that we had lots of help.
That help and what the people of Alaska have done for themselves in changing a frontier territory into a forward-moving state is what we will discuss today. Until after the beginning of this century, Native Eskimos, Aleuts, and Indians in this wilderness northland lived in an aboriginal state, just as their ancestors for centuries past. In the early 1900s, pioneer gold miners, fur trappers, and hunters who came from the south lived on what they could carry into the wilderness with them, or they lived off the land in their isolated existence. A few centers of population gradually developed at trading centers along navigable rivers or where unusual gold strikes were made. Until airplanes and the bush pilot came along, the principal means of transportation was by dog sled or on foot. It took weeks to reach a destination just a few hundred miles away. One ship a year visited Point Barrow, and a riverboat did go up the Yukon in the summer. In the long, cold winters, human beings and animals alike had to move slowly and cautiously to survive. Today, it's all different.
Our best to you from the Gold Rush crew of the Golden Nugget Jet. We welcome you to a rendezvous where the old and new are met. Your Golden Nugget flight will take you right, non-stop, to Anchorage Town. After a quiet climb and near 3 hours' time, we'll gently set you down.
That's Kathy Smith, a stewardess on an airline jet that quickly whisked me from Seattle to Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Nome. There are four major airlines from the lower 48 states into Alaska, and jet-powered internal airlines crisscross every part of the vast territory. In this Arctic land where roads and railroads are almost non-existent, the airplane has been one of the most important keys to development. After the daring exploits of bush pilots and tiny single-engine airplanes in the 1930s and 40s, came small feeder airlines. Many of these pioneer bush pilots got airline routes and today operate large craft throughout the state, hauling people and goods to every corner of Alaska. Wien Airlines, for instance, developed from the bush flying of the Wien brothers, Noel, Ralph, and Sig. This line now serves the area of Alaska above the Arctic Circle and has brought modern life to the Eskimo more than any other factor. The Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs is a special agency established to work with native populations in all areas of the United States. This includes the Eskimo, Aleuts, and Indians in Alaska. In Nome, I talked with Joseph Abrahamson of the Bureau, who described the amazing abilities of the Eskimo in particular.
The Eskimo people, as a whole, have very, very high mechanical aptitudes. They're really amazing people in that respect. You'll find many of the Eskimos who have acculturated already through process of education or training. Many are in mechanical positions. They've picked up the electronics field and been very successful in that. Many of them are airline mechanics. Many are pilots. And a special training program on geology and mining engineering was conducted at the University of Alaska this last year. And a group graduated. I think there were some 20 in that first group.
The U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs conducts a broad program for all the native population, providing free education and training right through the college level. Though there still are a few remote Indian and Eskimo villages in which people live much as in the past, these are now almost gone. As Abrahamson and others pointed out to me, most of the Eskimos, Aleuts, and Indians have blended in with the rest of society in Alaska. Vital to the 270,000 people of Alaska are the state's three colleges and universities: the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, Alaska Methodist University in Anchorage, and Sheldon Jackson Junior College in Sitka. Alaskans also experienced something that happened to other United States frontier areas as they developed. Dr. Peter Gordon Gould of Alaska Methodist University explains.
If one looks at the history of the United States, he discovers that each frontier area, as it developed, and as its young people grew into young manhood and womanhood, and as new resources were discovered, colleges in the East said, "Send your young people to us, we'll educate them." But these frontier areas discovered that the young people getting their education in colleges in the East stayed in the East to work out their careers. I found out that 95% of Alaska's young people leaving Alaska for their college education did not come back to Alaska after they got their education.
The state-owned University of Alaska was founded in Fairbanks in 1917 as one of the federally backed land-grant schools traditional in U.S. public education. The president, Dr. William Wood, describes where the students come from.
We have registered at the university this past year students from 101 or 102 communities in Alaska. Well, there are not more than a dozen communities with populations over 5 or 6,000. So we have here 95 communities or so, that none of which I believe would be over 200 or 300 inhabitants, and we have at least one student from each of those. This in itself is a major consequence, and I think it has a tremendous impact on what is happening in the state of Alaska.
And as it has all over the world through the ages, the church established institutions of learning. In Anchorage, where almost half the state's population is centered, the Methodist Church in 1960 opened Alaska Methodist University. Dr. Fred McGinnis, president of the school, outlines its role.
We believe that the role of the private university is to develop, first of all, a strong, first-rate liberal arts program with a strong emphasis on the humanities, the social sciences, the natural sciences, and to complement what the state university is doing. Especially are they interested in geophysical concerns, engineering concerns, mining concerns, the traditional land-grant college concerns, although they do indeed have a liberal arts program as well.
Alaska Methodist University was the idea and dream of a man you heard earlier, Dr. Peter Gordon Gould, who is now its director of development. Dr. Gould is of native Aleut descent. He was born the son of a poor fisherman in the Aleutian Islands and worked his way through schools in the eastern states. He persuaded the Methodist Board of Missions to conduct a national campaign for funds to establish the school. and the people of Anchorage raised a substantial amount. So the schools of higher learning in Alaska are now helping persuade young people to stay after they receive an education. And others from distant lands have discovered something in common with students in Alaska. Here again, Dr. Fred McGinnis.
One of the outstanding students that we had recently was from Kenya in Africa, who said he wanted to come to this institution because it was in a developing region, a new region, and he wanted to see the way that the free world helped a developing region build a new state, and therefore hopefully could be able to use some of those skills in helping to build his own country.
16 or more nations of the world are represented at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. And Alaska Methodist University has students from Tonga, from Japan, and from African nations. The Earth, this revolving orb on which we all live, is a plastic, unpredictable thing. There are parts of it which are always trembling and shaking from deep within. The atmospheric elements surrounding it can also be quite unpredictable. And Alaska, with all its fantasy and grandeur, is more than blessed with unusual geological and meteorological phenomena. It's a land of ice and snow and fantastic cold. It can also be dry and sweltering hot in places. Most of the state rests on a great geological fault that stretches from Japan across the northern Pacific through Alaska and western North America. It's one of the extensive areas of trembling earth, volcanoes, and upheaval. In 1964, a severe earthquake destroyed the town of Seward, parts of Kodiak, Valdez, and Anchorage. Robert Atwood, whom you've heard, was enjoying a bit of leisure time in his home practicing on his trumpet when the house began to tremble. He ran outside and watched his home sink into the earth around him. He doesn't know to this day if his musical ability or lack of it had something to do with that catastrophe. Fairbanks suffered two cataclysms in the 1967 summer. First, an earthquake shook the town and destroyed part of the 1967 Centennial Exposition site. Then floodwaters inundated the city. But adversity is nothing new to men and women of the frontier. None of these things has deterred the recovery and growth of Alaska. The people there are riding on the crest of a great wave of drive and enthusiasm following statehood in 1959. As a territory or colony, Alaska was managed and governed by Washington. Most of the affairs of Alaska were handled by the Department of the Interior. Here's how Robert Atwood put it.
As a territory, we were controlled in Washington, D.C., which is 3,000 miles away. The ultimate authority on everything pertaining to Alaska was Congress. And Congress, which is so busy with all the affairs of the nation and all the involvements of the nation and everything under the sun, that they rarely had time to give much consideration to Alaska.
Then, when Congress granted Alaska statehood in 1959, the local leadership in the territory took over.
In creating our new government, we had to write our constitution, we had to elect our legislature, our governor, and all of a sudden come up with leaders. Our political life was greatly expanded because for the first time we could vote for president. For the first time we had two members of the United States Senate representing us. And we also had full-fledged voting members with all the power of any member.
Statehood has stimulated an immense increase in business investment. Though manufacturing in the Arctic has not appeared to be practical, there are other industrial areas waiting to be developed. These are keyed to the natural resources of Alaska, and it has been blessed with many natural riches indeed. Commissioner of Natural Resources, Phil Holdsworth, told me that Alaska is sixth in known coal resources in the nation, seventh in natural gas, and eighth in petroleum reserves. It has a truly great timber potential, and already outside investment is coming in to harvest timber. Japanese industries have built a large pulp mill near Sitka and a lumber mill at Wrangell. These send wood and pulp to Japan for processing into many products of cellulose. Alaska's proximity to the Far East is only one of several distinctions of locality. It is as close to Tokyo as to New York. It is also closer to major European capitals in a straight line across the North Pole than are other parts of the United States farther south. This has made Alaskan airports international stopping points in air traffic back and forth across the pole, from Europe to the Far East, and from the rest of the United States to the Far East. Anchorage, particularly, is becoming a transportation hub of worldwide significance. This city and surrounding area of almost 120,000 people is where almost half of Alaska's population lives. Anchorage is the one true city in the state with tall buildings and wide streets. And as in other cities, it's hard to find a place to park an automobile. It has vitality and bustle, though it is losing the frontier warmth and personality of the interior. Robert Atwood, editor of the state's largest newspaper, describes the area.
The Cook Inlet Basin is a huge area, larger than most of the states of the original 48 states. We have ocean transportation because the Cook Inlet is an arm of the North Pacific. We have a moderate climate, winter and summer, that makes it very livable. It's something like Minneapolis, mild winters and cool summers. We have a good terrain that's easy to build on. We don't have permafrost. We have a terminal moraine, most of it, and easy, good gravel for foundations. We have all sorts of minerals in the mountains around us, including coal and gold, chrome, zinc, copper, and a long list of others. We have fine agricultural potentials, and the Matanuska Valley, just 50 miles from Anchorage, is the hub of agricultural development in Alaska. And more recently now, we have discovered oil in this area, and the Cook Inlet Basin, right under the water of Cook Inlet, the oil companies are finding one of the major reservoirs of the world. And with all these things, it indicates that as this state grows, we think it's inevitable that it will grow because of its position in the world and in Alaska. This is the area that's going to fill up with people first. This is the area that's going to have employment opportunities and economic opportunities for capital investments and the profits that make our country go and the way of living that we're all used to and understand. With the fewest of the strange phenomena that come with extreme cold or other extreme conditions.
Though there is still gold in the mountains and streams of Alaska, economic conditions make it relatively unprofitable to mine. There are, however, other great resources around the state to be developed. There is a large oil reserve beneath the Arctic tundra of Barrow. The timber potential in the southeastern island country has barely been tapped. Fisheries across the Gulf of Alaska and Bristol Bay are of tremendous importance to the economy of the state. The Alaska king crab from Kodiak has now become world famous. And cattle raising has also come to Kodiak Island, where the climate is relatively mild and there is grazing land for raising beef stock. There is under study a proposal to dam the great Yukon River as it flows through a narrow gorge at Rampart, northwest of Fairbanks. The resulting lake to the east toward Canada would impound a body of water larger than Lake Erie. Generator capacity could be some 5 million kilowatts. That's an old 19th century Nickelodeon at the Alaska 67 Exposition in Fairbanks, the center of the statewide centennial celebration. And throughout Alaska in this centennial year, special attractions and celebrations have been held to attract tourists to the 49th state and to develop historic archives and community centers. On a 40-acre site in Fairbanks, the Alaska 67 Exposition was established as a permanent attraction to display Indian and Eskimo exhibits, mining displays, a recreated gold rush town, a wildlife zoo, and a real Yukon River steamboat floating in a pond near the Chena Riverside. Sitka, the old Russian capital, built a beautiful centennial center which is to become a permanent convention hall. Already a large medical convention has termed it one of the loveliest of possible meeting sites. The people of Juneau voted themselves a local sales tax to match federal funds in building a new state museum. the people of Ketchikan reproduced a 10-meter Tlingit war canoe, which is paddled out to greet arriving tour ships. And a replica of an ancient fort has been built on a hillside nearby. In these locations, the federal government donated $600,000 for special centennial exhibits. And $4 million of federal aid was given Alaskan communities with which to match funds for local centennial projects of an enduring nature. That is the Moose Gooser, a little antique steam railroad train in Anchorage. It was put into operation as a special attraction in the spring of 1967 and has become one of the talking points of the city. It runs from the downtown railroad depot out to the Anchorage International Airport. There it terminates at this city's Centennial Project, a native cultural exhibit and aviation museum. And that is the sound of another train, today's narrow-gauge railroad as it climbs the track that runs from Skagway up over the White Pass Trail of 98, one of the routes taken by the Great Gold Stampede that opened the Yukon and Alaska. It's a ruggedly beautiful trip, and one that is now attracting thousands of visitors each year. The Alaska 67 Exposition suffered major flood damage when the Chena and Tanana rivers overflowed their banks in August 1967. But it will reopen again next year, and visitors may relive the days of the Great Gold Stampede. Or ride down the Tanana on Jim Binkley's sternwheel riverboat, the Discovery, the last one in Alaska. In Nome and Barrow, the visitor may see traditional Eskimo dances and a game called the blanket toss. And at Port Chilcoot on the green shores of Deep Blue Lynn Channel, native Tlingit Indian dances are recreated for the visitor. Throughout Alaska, the people are taking advantage of the wonderful potential for tourism. It's one of the most unusual and colorful places on Earth to visit. With fast jet air connections and modern conveniences, no more is it a hardship to go into this Arctic land. The heart of a land is its people. Lowell Thomas, Jr. is a world traveler and lecturer. He and his wife, Tay, decided to settle in Alaska.
I think the one thing that brought me here was just the great attraction of the unspoiled outdoors of Alaska. When I was a kid, just 16 years old, I came up on a mountain climbing expedition, and it kind of got under my skin. I think I was bitten by the Alaska bug. Well, it was many years before I had a chance to come back and brought my wife, Tay, along, and our daughter, Anne, and they also fell in love with Alaska, and we decided then, long about 1959, that we'd move up as soon as we could. And I must admit, at the same time, we were not too happy with living in suburbia. Mm-hmm. And we had been raised in the New York suburban areas, pretty much. And we decided that money just isn't everything in life. It's a lot, but it isn't everything. In a way of life means a great deal also, and with children coming along, and we found Alaska was just ideal for all of us.
Thomas is now a state senator, and he and his wife are quite active in Anchorage civic activities. The average age of Alaskans is believed to be in the 20s, as a new generation of people, all born there, are beginning to take over. In Nome, a few old-timers are still mining gold. And hundreds of people in Nome would like nothing better than to see conditions right for another great rush for the precious yellow rocks. Bon Davis, at 65, is still working a claim in the mountains outside Nome. I met him as he was about to go out to his mine and asked him why he continued to prospect for gold.
The life that I have out there, where I'm out away from everything, you might say everybody. You kind of get away from it all, and then particularly if you've been dealing with people for a good part of the year, it's really a vacation.
Herb Engström, who came from Sweden, is still mining too. Though the living isn't what it used to be, he wouldn't stop. I talked with him out at his claim.
We made a living here. Made a good living here.
Well, you're one of the last miners still in this country.
I am the last. If I had any sense, I'd quit too. But as it is, nobody wants me now anyway. I'm 75 years old. You've got to remember that. It's getting up in...
You know you've got gold down there, though, don't you?
Yeah, we do that. You see, this gold don't come up and kiss you. Lord knows I can make an easier living than that if I wanted to, see what I mean? To work for other work if I didn't want to fight this end of it, see mm-hmm. what I mean? But it's a free life.
When he first came to Alaska from the Netherlands, the promise was of gold and riches to Gerrit Heine Snyder of Wasilla. But it turned out to be for something else in the long run.
Alaska has been to us one of the best places that I know of to live, because in all my travels throughout the world as a hobo and as a free traveler, I found that in the United States the greatest things to all of us is the national freedom we may have here. But in Alaska, we have a certain a greater amount of freedom, individual freedom, I will say, than any place in the world. And I had also the good fortune of becoming the senator of the Alaska Territorial Legislature. And I'm mighty proud that me, the son of a shoemaker from the old country, had that distinction.
The future of Alaska rests in the hands of descendants of people like Bob Atwood, Lowell Thomas, Bon Davis, Herb Engström, Gerrit Snyder, and sourdough miner and hunter Frank Young. Their children and grandchildren are becoming second and third generation Alaskans. As a man who lived in the mountains and forests almost all his life, Frank Young loves everything about interior Alaska.
I don't know. There's something about it that we look forward to. Like in the summer, we raise our gardens. We can get all the wild berries we want, raspberries, blueberries, strawberries, red currants, black currants, and dewberries, and salmon berries. And then we get all the summer fishing, grayling, whitefish, trout, and... Salmon, and then we come into the hunting season. An old timer like myself knows the country, and I know where we can go and get all the moose we want and get all the caribou we want, and I enjoy that kind of a life. Maybe it's I've been used to it so many years that just something about it that we just can't get away from.
So they came to Alaska in the beginning looking for quick riches, following the lure of gold. But the hunter, the trapper, the gold prospector, and those who came after them found another kind of riches. The promise of a free life on the frontier. The rugged, hardy, and adventurous men and women who truly opened Alaska, the last frontier.
Alaska, the Last Frontier, the fourth and last of a series of programs about the history, the people, the legend, and the promise of the colorful 49th state. This program was written and narrated by Rhett Turner. Music was played by the Anchorage Philharmonic Orchestra. This is Jack Weitzel speaking for the Voice of America, Studio One.